This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. A new bill to keep the federal government funded through September does not include cuts to Planned Parenthood, but President Trump signed legislation last month to cut funding to that organization and other groups that perform abortions. Now, to be clear, federal funds do not cover abortion costs at all, so that's not a change, and that won't change in the future. Physician Willie Parker is on a mission to help keep abortion clinics open in the South. He's the author of a new book, Life's Worth, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker speaks tonight at the Carter Center in Atlanta and joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. Great to be with you.
Now, you put this in terms of a moral argument. Why did you put it that way rather than a medical argument?
Well, there's no contention medically around abortion, and I frame it as a moral argument and not a religious argument, because how people feel about whether or not things ought to happen and whether or not they're right or wrong, they don't go to medical institutions to figure that out. They go to what I call the value-issuing institutions, faith communities. And so I think we've done everything with regard to abortion to prove its worthiness. It's unequivocal that it's safe for women. We even rebut notions that it could be a cruel procedure. But what we haven't done is we haven't centered women in the decision by validating and affirming their right as human beings to make decisions about their lives and bodies. And I think their ability to do that is a moral decision. And so somebody needs to make an argument for them to do that.
Now, this is one of those areas, perhaps the chief area, in which medical decisions are, in the end, end up being in the hands of religious, sometimes, institutions, or at least influenced. What you want, a physician may want to do medically is at least affected by religious opinions. How big of a problem, I hate to say problem, because maybe it's not a problem, how big of an issue is that, do you think, for physicians in the U.S.?
Well, I think you describe it right, Celeste. It is a problem. It's a problem to the extent that a significant portion of medical care access is provided by hospitals that are built and supported by faith institutions. Like the Catholic healthcare system controls a large portion of healthcare access, to include reproductive health access. And so when religious institutions allow their particular values to influence the healthcare mission, you have issues of conflict where they will say, we are a hospital and we provide reproductive health services, but those services only include birth. They would not include a woman's right to end a pregnancy, whether that be that she has an unplanned unwanted pregnancy, or that she has a wanted but lethally flawed pregnancy that she wants to give birth to, but it's clear that that fetus is not viable. So that religious hospitals constitute a significant part of healthcare access, it becomes extremely problematic because doctors are bound by the charter and the mission of the hospitals where they practice.
Your book makes it clear that this has been a sort of an evolution for you and your ideas about abortion. I want to play for you two differing opinions on what women are sort of weighing in their minds. The first is Emily Mattson. She's the executive director of Georgia Life Alliance. It is a hyper against abortion group, and we spoke to her in January.
I actually don't think a lot of women who make this choice struggle with whether or not it's a human. The question is, can they bear the burden of being a parent? If we believe in human rights and the sanctity of human life, then that belief in the value of human rights should extend not just to the person who can speak for their defense, but for the human beings that cannot say anything for their defense, which are the unborn.
Okay, so that's one view from an anti-choice group. Now let's hear from Melissa Grant. She is Vice President of Health Services at CARFM. CARFM recently opened two abortion clinics in Georgia, and we asked her if she thought expanding abortion privileges in Georgia could lead to more restrictions here.
Well, frankly, I'd say that CARFM is focused on the health and well-being of our women that need us, our clients, and not our critics, and that previously not speaking to those critics has not in any way slowed them down on the offensive. I also would tell you, as a healthcare professional, I know firsthand women don't make these decisions lightly. So we need to be able to reach out to them with open, honest conversation about their healthcare options and what's available to them.
So you have two people here. One who says women are making this choice not based on the human rights of their fetus, and the other one who's saying they absolutely do. This is a heavy decision. Who's right in your experience?
Well, I think part of the problem is the creation of the zero-sum game and the fact that it's possible to talk about fetuses or unborn as I think both are language that one's an accurate developmental description, one is a derived notion. What does unborn mean? but it's that it's possible to have this conversation and not center women in it. In terms of even if you decide that a developing pregnancy, a fetus is a person, what is still problematic is that if that person's inside of another person, how do you appropriate rights to the person that's inside of another person without compromising the rights of the person that they're in? So if a woman loses her bodily autonomy, her agency to decide what's in her best interest and her health simply because she's in the midst of a biologic process, 50% of which are unplanned, then at what point, what does it mean to be a person? So I'm less concerned about the question of whether or not a fetus is a person. What I need someone to really tell me is, when is a woman not a person?
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with physician Willie Parker. He's author of the new book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice, and Parker will speak tonight at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Now, you have said that you were conflicted, and one of the things that you write about when we talk about your struggle was about not whether women have the right to choose, but whether or not you should provide these services specifically. So how did you weigh that? What were the pros and cons for you?
Well, growing up in the South, in Birmingham, and making my own religious decision to become a Christian at the age of 15, I was never taught that abortion was wrong, but I was conflicted about what it meant to me because I had not thought deeply or seriously about abortion because I didn't have to. As a male, I was never going to have an unplanned pregnancy. And as someone just kind of very sure about what I thought Christianity meant and what it meant to me, I sailed through college and medical school and finally had to think about that when I became a women's health provider and saw women who had unplanned, unwanted, or wanted but lethally flawed pregnancies. And so I had to then wrestle with what it meant to be a Christian and then to also be a women's health care provider and decide what should be my compassionate response to women presenting to me with a health challenge. And so if you are thoughtful in any way, to have conflict and to have tension is a process of thinking. And so I decided that I want to think for myself. I've always felt that way. And so I began to explore what it meant to be Christian and whether or not there was really anything that prevented me from providing this service to women. And I ultimately concluded that it was more important for me to respond compassionately to my patients as a women's health provider than to be more concerned about what other Christians thought about abortion or what they would think about me for providing them.
But there are doctors who make the choice to stay out of it, to not provide them because they don't want to be involved in politics.
Sure.
They just want to remain neutral. But you travel long distances in order to continue to provide these. Why make that choice?
Well, to your point about there, many of my colleagues stay out and stay neutral. But how do you remain neutral on a human rights issue, right? You're either a part of the problem or you're part of the solution. There's taciturn approval and complicit. Dr. King said, if our society perishes, and if our society collapses, it won't be the behavior of the vitriolic, mean-spirited people. It will be the appalling silence of the good people. So to be neutral, there's no neutrality when it comes to an issue of human rights. And so I came to see that one, there's nothing mutually exclusive between my being a Christian and having compassion for my patients. And to me, it felt disingenuous to have care and concern about what happens to women when abortion is not available. That it became problematic that I knew what was necessary and couldn't do it. We know that abortion is safe when it is legal, But when it's illegal, women die.
And that leads us to the lawsuit you end up being party to in Mississippi. You were unable to get admitting privileges, and you applied to how many regional hospitals?
In the catchment area that would have been relevant, it was 11 hospitals around in the Jackson area.
And what reason did they give you for not giving you admitting privileges?
Well, for the ones that responded, they said that because you indicate your intent to provide abortion care that is not consistent with the mission of this hospital, and it would pose conflicts for us both internally and politically, and so we will not act on your application.
So it would be quite easy for you to stay in Chicago and say, okay, Mississippi, you're on your own, right?
Absolutely.
Why file suit? Why continue the fight?
Well, it didn't make sense to me for me to leave my faculty position at the University of Hawaii years prior to pursue training in abortion care and to commit myself clinically to providing care for individuals should they make it to me, but then not participate in the very battle that would determine whether or not women would have access to the care. And these restrictions that were being posed by the state and by changing the regulations posed a threat to the only clinic open in that state. So it didn't make sense for me to be willing to travel to Mississippi to provide abortion care, but then to shrink away from participating in the fight that would keep that care available.
But other doctors have died. They've lost their lives in this fight, particularly in the Deep South. How much of a concern has that been, and how has it played into your decision?
I choose to think about it. There's a difference between awareness and concern. Am I aware that doctors have died? Absolutely. Three of the four doctors who were killed, it happened before I even decided to provide abortion care. Am I concerned? Absolutely. As rational, healthy self-interest says that my fight or flight response is like everybody else's. But rather than being concerned about hypothetical risk, I choose to interact with actual ones. And there have been no real physical threats or risk to me. And so I choose to focus on the importance of what I do, and I choose to focus on what I live for versus what potentially could end my life.
So we are in a kind of a unique moment for scientists and for doctors like yourself. We're coming off the heels of the March for Science in a way that many scientists said they never thought they would have to be marching to protest for facts. Mm-hmm. What kind of position do you think scientists should take? And the reason I ask that is because there's this argument. Do you stay out of politics, or do you enter into this debate, which at this moment is a political debate?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been much to our chagrin, the hubris that we have in science that we're all rational beings and that if you just put the facts out there, they are self-evident. To live in society with people, but to fail to recognize that you're political simply because you live in community with other folk is a short-sightedness. The Mahatma Gandhi said that if I choose to participate in politics, it's only because politics encores us all like the coils of a huge snake. No matter how hard we try, we can't get out. So I simply, therefore, choose to wrestle with the snake. And so what scientists have come to realize is that, there are political processes, and to participate as a citizen and to not abdicate your responsibility to participate in the political process is by not participating in the political process, you don't stand above and you don't lose your objectivity when you engage as a citizen. So I think they're seeing that facts matter, but because of politics, there's now the opportunity to create alternative facts. And so creating this false equivalency is only possible because scientists have refused to participate politically. Facts matter, because my evidence that facts matter is that if facts didn't matter, there would be no such thing as alternative facts. People don't fake things that don't matter. So that we have alternative facts is because scientists to date have not participated, and now they get it. And now we're standing up to say, facts matter. That's what we do. We create the facts, and we demand as citizens that you listen to the facts that we create.
So who, in the end, are you speaking to with your book? Are you speaking to your average citizen who is going to confront this either in the ballot box or in their own lives, or are you speaking to other physicians?
I'm speaking to everybody. Why? Because everybody's participating in this conversation. And what I'm hoping to do is to change the conversation, to move it away from what I call a false equivalence to a dialogue that can lead to honest disagreement. I'm not out to change anybody's mind. If you really firmly believe that life begins at conception and you are opposed to abortion, we live in a country that you are entitled to that. What I'm saying is there are religious or non-empiric ways of understanding the world, and there are scientific empiric ways. They're not in competition. I'm hoping to have bring both of those to the table, an intellectually honest and rigorous conversation about reproduction, and a morally a position of religious, spiritual, and moral integrity that also speaks meaningfully to reproduction, and to show that those aren't mutually exclusive. So I'm hoping that people on both sides of the issue will read the book, and then when they come together, they can honestly disagree.
That is Willie Parker. He will speak tonight at the Carter Center about his new book. His new book is called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. The speech tonight is at 7 o'clock at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Dr. Parker, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.